So what is it about the Iditarod that gets people hooked? As we're about to hear, it's costly and it's unimaginably tough to run this race. And now, they want you to do it faster. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. A book on those who did not complete the Iditarod is out, and it's fascinating. Our number statewide and toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Craig Medrid is our guest on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
You're not reading Craig Medred's columns in the Anchorage Daily News as you did for, 30-odd years. He's been working on a book, and it's out. It's entitled Graveyard of Dreams, Dashed Hopes and Shattered Aspirations Along Alaska's Iditarod Trail. And Craig is with us today. He now writes for the Alaska Dispatch. He took a buyout from the shrinking Anchorage Daily News and decided he could cover the Iditarod for the Dispatch and get a book out of it. I think we'll hear his take on this, but I would say he liked the idea of hanging out at the very back of the pack and seeing if there was a story in the people who did not complete the Iditarod, and that's the book he wrote. And it is very revealing. It's revealing about the nature of the race. It's revealing about human nature. And I think this is, Craig, what we always get when people actually go out and do a pilgrimage, an ordeal, they come out of it different. They come out of it transformed. They come out of it a different person. And that's what we see in this. We see people learning a whole lot in this one race that, you know, takes less than 10 days these days.
Yeah, it's great. Challenges transform people, whether you accomplish the challenge or not. And a bunch of people in here didn't accomplish the challenge. Some of them I noticed are coming back to try again this year, but a bunch didn't. A bunch left very conflicted, and a couple, because I didn't want the book to end up on too much of a downer, a couple overcome pretty, in one case, difficult physical challenges, and in the other, kind of emotional challenges to finish. And they were, in the end, quite inspirational.
Yeah. This is, when did you cover your first Iditarod?
I was trying to think about that as I came in this morning, and I think it was 1983, because I think my first race was the year Rick Mackey won, which was his only victory. And we were talking before we went on the air about Cowboy Smith, who led a good part of that race. And looking back, it probably should have been won by Susan Butcher. It probably should have been her first victory, but she got lost with a bunch of people on the Yukon River, coming up the Yukon River to Caltag, and I just remember it really well because Rick was with her. And Rick had, and has always had, a reputation for real sleep problems. I remember in Shagaluk before they hit the river, he was a basket case. He couldn't hardly find the room, let alone, you know, his sled or anything else.
I say King is like that, too.
Sometimes. Problem. And Rick just, you know, it was like you wouldn't have given him a chance. And they went up the river, and they got lost. I remember Terry Adkins was one of those with him. And I think it was Terry who finally looked at his compass and said, guys, we've been heading due east for 2 hours. We should be going north. And they kind of sorted it all out and figured out they were on some trail the local villagers had put into somewhere. And they all turned around. They went back, and they came into Caltag. And Susan it was over. She was demoralized. She was, my dogs, you know, their heads are fried. I can't do this to them. We can't do this. And she pulled the plug. And Rick Mackey was transformed. He was mad. He was going to win this race. He used a bunch of profanity we can't repeat on the air, but it was like, I'm going to win this thing. I've had it with this race. And he went on to do that, coached, ironically enough, near the end by Adkins and Cowboy, who saw Rick Swenson closing in and kept saying, okay, here's what you got to do to beat Rick on the coast. And Mackey listened to all their advice and won the race.
Yeah, yeah. Rick Mackey.
Rick Mackey.
That's this is a family that's got three
champions.
Yeah,
winners. Yeah, and Lance is probably the least likely. I mean, Lance was hardly on the radar at that point, and he's in the book because when he ran his first race, nobody would have given him a chance of ever becoming a contender, let alone a winner.
Yeah. We're talking with Craig Medred. He is author of Graveyard of Dreams. How is this book being distributed? I understand Amazon's got it.
Amazon's got it. It will soon be into local bookstores. It should soon be into Cars and Safeway here. Fireside Books out in Palmer has it, or their website has it if you want to order it. Steam Dot, where I'm doing a signing, which is a new coffee shop that Jonathan White started in South Anchorage, should soon have it. We'll be there the 7th from 5 to 7 p.m. if somebody wants to come and talk about the book.
You said you were going to Gustavus?
Yeah, we're heading to Gustavus for the Glacier Bay Lodge for the weekend to do a book signing down there. And it's kind of, we're starting with Alaska. We're trying to spread out from here. It's a small publisher with like four titles that's a startup. It's an adventure on many levels that is a lot of fun. I don't know if we're going to make much money, but it's a lot of fun.
Well, yeah, you know, it was, I mean, for you, I can't even imagine the kind of limb you climbed out on leaving the Daily News and that beat that you've had forever and gone with the Dispatch, which is not going to be the most lucrative job in the world, and taking the risk of saying, I can get this book done in a month.
Well, I suggested this book at the Daily News a couple times, and people looked at me like I'd suggested we build an Apollo rocket and go to the moon to mine green cheese.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, I really think we can cover the back of the pack by snow machine. Just let me go. And they were, that, you know, there's always reasons not to do things. I mean, it's part of the problem of big business in America is that it becomes about why things can't be done. And going to Dispatch was a little startup that said, hey, you want to try something crazy? What do we got to lose? They said, if you can find somebody to you know, offer you a snowmobile to use, go for it. So I went over to Alaska Mining and Diving Supply on a whim and talked to Dudley and Steve and said, gee, you know, I'm thinking about doing this. You guys always been big fans of the Iditarod. Would you loan me a snow machine? They said, sure. And I was like, what? And they, yeah, when do you want to pick it up? And I was shocked by their willingness to help out with this thing. And the next thing I knew, I was out on the trail and it getting a lot of help from a lot of people along the way and twittering like crazy. And it was a marvelous adventure of its own, none of which is in the book, which
yeah.
Some of the editors who read it for me said, oh, no, you need to write more yourself in here. And I said, I don't want to write any of me in there because it's really not about me.
You held your ground on that.
Oh, yeah. It's about the people there. They're fascinating. They're wonderful. In retrospect, I feel guilty about some of the people who were left out that really deserved more attention in the book. But there's only so much time. And as it turned out, there was a lot of reporting, kind of filling in holes left to be done after I got back. And we were really up against it to turn this thing around as fast as we did.
Wow. So do you think you might try and go back and do a re-edit on it at some point?
I don't know if I want to go back and do a re-edit. I don't know if I want to find another book. I'm kind of still sorting out this whole book thing. It did reconnect me with the fact there are really, really good stories in Alaska.
One of the most fascinating things about the book is the geography. You inform the entire book, not just with the human dimension of it, but with the very hard geography of this is what it's like between this place and that place. I've read these descriptions hundreds of times in the official press handout and everything, and yet you're telling me things that I hadn't ever thought about. Mushers could have told me, I guess, about how you don't want to be the last ones going up into the Alaska Range because there's going to be these ruts on these curves.
The ruts are horrible. You know, the thing that impressed me as much as the geography, which I knew pretty well, was the history. I mean, that broad swath of the state between the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers that used to be just crawling with miners and development, and now it's all but gone. I mean, you find these little outposts of of wreckage left. It's just fascinating how much the state has changed and how much has gone away that we forget about.
Yeah, and Reddington was that was a big part of his why he wanted to do this in the first place, along with the Army people that helped lay out that
trail.
Yeah,
and I mean, we have a lot more history in this state than we realize. I mean, there were a lot of people in a lot of places of Alaska at the turn of the century looking for gold. I mean, it's amazing where you find that they've been, and kind of to go back, get a trip through that is really an experience everyone should have.
Our subject is those who fail to complete a sled dog race across 1,000 miles of Alaska, more or less, more, I'd say. Our guest is Craig Medred. He is author of Graveyard of Dreams. It is a book that is just out and looks like it's going to go to the second printing and has very little distribution outside of Alaska unless you go to Amazon.com. It's a book about people that did not complete the Iditarod, although it brushes across some who did complete the Iditarod. Libby Riddles was mentioned, and of course Rick Swenson, and very much the case of Lance Mackey. Not so much Rick Mackey that we were just talking about, and not so much about Dick Mackey. It mostly concentrates on this year's race, 2010, and why the people who did not complete the race did not complete it. And that is, I always knew there would be stories there. And you read some of those stories in the newspaper, in the coverage of so-and-so scratched because of thus and such, and oh, isn't it too bad, you know, that they almost, you know, horribly injured or, what, you know, whatever it was. But this, it's all in context, Craig, and it's really nice to get a real feel for these people and the kind of willpower that is really required, and then the knowledge you need to acquire if you really want to get serious about this race.
Yeah, and scratching, I mean, having watched people scratch, maybe the most difficult thing an Iditarod musher ever does, no matter who they are, because they are so invested emotionally. It's like breaking a relationship off. I mean, a long-term marriage or something, and you just decide it won't work, and now you're going to end it. And, there are probably people all over who can identify with that, the kind of emotional trauma you go through. And, boy, these people go through some emotional trauma.
Well, we just saw the sign-ups, and we see that some of these very people that you write about are going to be back. Mike Supernant?
Mike Supernant's back.
Give me a little thumbnail on him, because that was kind of a tough one, because he really he really thought he might have a shot for a while.
He's a guy that I expected to be back and didn't expect to be back, mainly because he's kind of the last of the old school, do it on a shoestring, running a kennel out of Chugiak, got volunteer help, not much money kind of mushers that there used to be a lot of, and we're increasingly shifting to people with money, people who can afford a handler to help them train. And Mike's the old school, doing it because he loves to do it, be happy to finish, has no chance of winning, but really is in it for being out there with the dogs. A couple other people back who have some potential to do more than that, who I think still have big dreams. They buried him out there. They dug him up again, dusted him off, and said, hey, you know, I can be a contender. That's a wonderful thing, but boy, it is... It is so much harder than you think. I mean, to finish is difficult. To contend is beyond difficult.
Yeah, and I think we heard this from Swingley, and we hear it every year from King. You know, it really is harder when you get older.
Well, I think the harder part as you get older is just the training. I mean, to stick to the schedule, to be constantly at it, and I think it was probably captured best, and I put Bert Baumhoff in the book, who was a former Iditarod president who did a bunch of races and who often was in contention till the middle when his problems with sleep kind of caught up with him. But, I remember him telling me that the day he went home after work and decided he wanted to have a glass of wine with dinner and decided he couldn't have a glass of wine because it might, you know, take just enough of an edge off that he'd sit back and not go out and run those dogs. I think that about said it all. And that's the point at which he said, I've got to get out of this.
Yeah. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Our guest is Craig Medred, and our email is talk@aprn.org. We're talking Iditarod again. We saw a situation this year where the Red Lantern really went to someone who ran a faster race than winners used to win, run.
Yeah, and I felt really sorry for David Straub, who was the former record holder for the Red Lantern pace. And it may have been really one of the few things he ever accomplished in life, and to have it wiped out is pretty startling. But, I mean, we got really good weather. The coast was really cooperative. It's hard to explain to people how beautiful that coast, the Bering Sea coast, is when the weather is nice. I mean, I know that I stopped on top of what mushers call Little McKinley, and the whole Bering Strait stretches out from there, and there was ice moving all over, and the sun was out, and it was warm, and I sat there on the snow machine and had lunch and got my satellite phone out and called people back in Anchorage who were at work and harassed them, saying, gee, what are you doing? And the whole coast was that way for the end of this race, which really helped out those people at the back. I mean, they were, at least those who still had good dog teams, were loving every minute of the coast, and that really sped things along.
We had a situation with a couple of mushers who were withdrawn from the race and don't feel good about it, Emil Churchin and Hank De Bruin. You know, in Emil's case, it just, boy, things really kind of fell apart towards the end there. But he is very unhappy with the trail committee. He feels that they changed the rules in the middle of the game.
Well, they weren't. They actually weren't withdrawn. They were encouraged to scratch. It was Emil and Hank De Bruin. They both scratched. I think scratching's a really difficult thing. There's always this belief that you could have, if you know this had been different, or if that had been different, I could have caught up. It's a very difficult thing for the race because keeping checkpoints open is costly. Monitoring people at the very back is costly. It's a tough decision for everyone all around, and I kind of tried to capture some of that in the book. I know that when we reported on it at the time, some of the people in Iditarod were really, really mad at me. I haven't heard from any of them directly about it since, but I got an email from a couple of them the other day, so I think that's gone away, and they think it was handled fairly in the book. But it's a tough call for everyone. It's tough to ask someone to scratch. It's really tough to say, look, you know, this isn't going to work. We need you to drop out, because I don't think Iditarod wants to ask anyone to get out. No. I think they want everyone to finish, but, you know, there comes a point at which, you know, this guy's two checkpoints behind everybody else. We're going to have to keep a bunch of people there to handle them, to help them. It's just hard to justify that, especially when they're in all the financial trouble they're in now. And boy, I feel for Emil. Was one of those people I almost wanted to cry for. It was so painful to watch.
Yeah, well, it certainly bummed him out.
Well, His situation was one of those times, and there were others when, I mean, the mushers aren't allowed any help, but you want to help. And I remember going out from Ruby on snow machines because, you know, we kept hearing he was camped out like 4 miles out of Ruby, which didn't make any sense. And Emil didn't know how close he was to Ruby, sadly. And I remember getting out there, and it was early in the morning, and the sun was just coming up, and it was bitterly cold, and the sun was cold, and Emil was cold, and the dogs were cold, and, you know, race officials kind of had a chat with him and told him how close Ruby was, and, you know, said, you really need to just get him up and get him moving. And Emil kept trying. Emil was, you know, sleep deprived and stumbling around and not too clear what he was doing. He kept trying to get dogs that would go. No dogs would go. And he had one dog, like probably in second swing, something like that, that just was up and barking and jumping. And I kept looking at this dog going, okay, Emil, here's your leader. And, you know, somebody would suggest it, and Emil would kind of go, that dog's not a leader. And I'd kind of, you know, you just wanted to say, look, put this dog in the front. He's going to be a leader now. And I mean, Emil finally got him going, but you just kind of wanted to go in there and say, look, I had a full night's sleep, and I'm telling you, you got one dog here that wants to go. Put him at the front of this team and sees what happens. But I mean, Emil, the people on the trail are in a different world because they're so tired. You know, they've spent so much time on that sled thinking, you know, the whole trail over, you're thinking about what went wrong. You're thinking about how you should have done things differently. You've got all these preconceived ideas about what dogs do what, and it can become as much of a handicap as an asset.
Yeah, I've heard that before. And I've heard that it's just the sleep deprivation adventure of it is, you know, there's hallucination. There's not knowing whether you really are asleep or not. there's all sorts of things.
And there's a sense of confidence that can go either way. I mean, you lose it or you gain it. I remember talking to Martin Boozer a couple times, including the year he set the record, about how there came a point and that record still stands. There came a point at which he just thought his dog team could do anything and that they all seemed to feed on the same positive energy. And, the faster they went, the faster everybody wanted to go, including him. And I've seen it go the other way, that people just, you know, they emotionally get really down and the dogs start getting down and everything just keeps going downhill.
Yeah. Well, in the case of Emil, he took everything he had. Throw it into this thing. And, you know, granted, he's got a job. He gets a salary. He can start all over again. I don't know if he will.
He took everything he had. He borrowed money from friends.
But so many people do this.
All of his money, he took all of his emotional stock, as far as I could tell. I mean, and threw everything into this and didn't make it. But he wasn't alone. I mean, Jane Faulkner borrowed money against her house to do this. And, you know, after telling me, was like, don't tell my banker. And I'm like, well, what difference does it make? They can't get it back now.
I never have understood what is the attraction that would catch a person up so much that they kind of are going against all sorts of common sense.
Well, it's a magnificent challenge. It's a stunning country, and when it's all going well, it's the most marvelous experience in the world to be out there traveling behind a dog team. I mean, they're all just kind of these little friends of yours, just perking along. It's quiet. I don't think I've seen a lot of places in the world. I don't think there's many places as beautiful as the heart of Alaska in the winter, and it's kind of weird to say that because it's cold and it's forbidding, but it's that kind of grandeur that goes on forever that gives it its attraction. You'll never see wilderness like that anywhere else. It intimidates some people, and to others, it's just too much to resist.
We're talking Iditarod again. Here it is, right in the middle of summer, and Craig Medved is our guest. He's author of Graveyard of Dreams, a book just out, Dashed Hopes and Shattered Aspirations Along Alaska's Iditarod Trail. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255. Across the state and toll-free. If you're calling from Anchorage, it's 550-8422. And email is talk@aprn.org. So here we have this dog race all across the state of Alaska in the dead of winter, and these people throw their life savings into it. And Craig has tried to speak for them in terms of what the real attraction is. Now, you've seen, you know, I noticed that Linwood Fiedler is going to be back.
Linwood's back?
I didn't see
Linwood's name on the list.
I might have got that wrong.
I don't remember seeing Linwood's name on the list. I would be somewhat surprised if Linwood is back. I think Linwood's kind of reached that age where he's decided he probably can't win it. And if he can't win it, I think it's pretty hard to transition from being a contender to being someone just doing it for fun. I think that's really hard.
Well, okay, let's take the case of another one coming back is Zoya Denur.
Zoya Denur, who...
She probably would say herself that I really shouldn't have done the race.
She had the strangest excuse I've ever run into in an Iditarod musher for dropping out. She was lactating and had stopped nursing and had got a breast infection, and the doctors told her that, you know, this needs antibiotic treatment and you have to go back to Anchorage, which When I first started covering the Iditarod, you couldn't imagine running into a problem like that. I mean, there were very few women running, let alone women who were mothers, let alone women who'd had a baby not that long ago. So it kind of caught me by surprise. But Zoya is open, and it's like, oh, yeah, this is the problem I got. And, you know, that she talked about it kind of also caught me by surprise. But, yeah, I'm sure she'll be back. She's married to John Schandelmeyer, who's won the quest. They have a really interesting dog team. They're into saving pound dogs and making sled dogs out of them. And she's pretty committed to that. It's a real interesting operation.
The nature of the race is changing. At the press briefing this year, it was quite different from previous press briefings. They didn't have the sort of self-glorification like they have been getting into, where they show their own lavish self-praising documentary and all the press has to sit through it. And then they answer a few questions, and they didn't do it this time. They answer the questions right at the beginning, and, you know, they had the drug test question they had to go to, and they had the financial question. And it's a very serious question. I mean, the purse was reduced. They have invested money into basically beefing up their internet presence. They ask people to subscribe. They're making more money than they ever have before on their fans. So they're very much more dependent on their fans. In other words, it's evolving into a kind of a completely different kind of sport now.
Yeah, and philosophically, there's a split within the marching community itself as to what they want it to be. I mean, there are a bunch of people kind of want it to be the NASCAR of dog racing, and then there are a bunch of other people who really want it to be, I mean, more along the lines of what Joe Reddington envisioned, and a challenge for a bunch of those people who are the kind of people in the book who may not do it again, who want to do, you know, this great adventure in Alaska. And I don't know how that's going to all shake out. I have some reservations about the NASCAR model. I really don't think that there's much to sell in terms of product there. I think that from a sponsor standpoint, you know, these people engaged in an epic battle against nature are probably as marketable or more marketable than the winners. Although, you know, Lance Mackey kind of incorporates both, so you couldn't ask for much more in a champion. You know, a gritty, earthy, down-to-earth, you know, just all-around good guy who's as common folk as common folk get. I mean, you can't not love the guy.
Well, as a person, and you're one of these too, who likes to get out, who does accept a personal physical challenge or whatever it is, distance hiking or climbing or, you know, paddling rapids or whatever it is, accepting that challenge. I think a person who does that, and this is probably a good feature of the book and why it has the resonance it does, you were able to sympathize with every damn one of these people.
And before I did this, before I went and covered Iditarod for Dispatch, I did the Iditarod Invitational, which is the mountain bikers and runners and whatnot. And it really...
Oh, you did?
Yeah. And it really struck me then. And what I really enjoyed about that was that those folks were so much like the old Iditarod folks. I mean, it was just a bunch of people trying to get to the end. They were helping each other out all the time. They were in it very much together. There wasn't the competitive aspect that some of the front of the Iditarod has become now. It was a very pleasant experience to be with those people on the trail, as it was to be with most of these people on the trail. And the front has become in significant part, a very intense affair, which, you know, it's nice to keep track of who wins and to, you know, cover that part of the race, but it's not that much fun to hang with those people anymore.
Craig Medred is our guest, author of Graveyard of Dreams, and telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call on Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@APRN.org. And Greg and Wasilla, if you just hang on there, we will get to your question immediately after the break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
It's Talk of Alaska. The subject is the Iditarod, and specifically a fascinating book, Graveyard of Dreams, about the people who did not complete the 2010 Iditarod. You might think of that book as a bit of a clunker, but it's not. These are very compelling stories, and it really delineates how stringent this experience of a 1,000-mile race being in charge of a group of dogs who are far better athletes than you are, and the challenges that it presents along with the climate, your fellow mushers, the difficulties of the trail grooming and all the other things. And this was one of those years where the trail was actually pretty good compared to other trails. Craig Medred is our guest. He's written this book after covering the race for years and covering the back of the pack this time around. Craig, before we go to Greg's call from Wasilla, you must have run into Peterson doing sweeper this year?
Oh yes, yes
yeah.
He was.
So you and him probably got along.
Ran into him several times.
Yeah, I would think so. Let's go to Greg. Joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Greg.
Hi. Hey, Craig. This is Greg from Mushing Magazine. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you. Hey, I wanted to get your take because we've never talked about this before, but you know, obviously the Iditarod has evolved as any successful sporting event does, and it's evolved tremendously. And you know, its trajectory is what it is. But what is your take on perhaps it's splitting into a professional and amateur divisions? You know, there are very few sporting events, large sporting events in the world, which allow professionals and amateurs to compete side by side. You know, the argument can be made that it's not fair for either of them to be judged in the same bracket. What's your take on the pro-am style or business model of the future of the Iditarod?
Well, I really don't know, because I don't know how you would sort it out that way. I mean, Iron Dog tried to do that, and everybody wanted to be a professional, so the amateur class never really had anyone involved. You know, my greatest fear, and I would be that you make you split it into a quote unquote professional class and a bunch of rich guys, and I mean, if there's anything I'm uncomfortable with now, it's kind of how we're losing, you know, the average Alaskan who used to be involved in this, particularly the people from the bush, and that's a little unsettling. I miss some of those guys. I probably shouldn't confess this, but I got talking to some people in Ruby about all this, and there's a young guy I used to know well in the trail when I first started named Howard Elbert, who was a heck of a young musher and eventually committed suicide. And we got talking about the old days and Howard, and you know, the loss of bush people in the race. And I mean, I ended up sitting there crying and having a heck of a time getting the tears stopped, because it just hit me so deeply. I mean, Howard was a guy who, I don't know if we were brothers in some other life or what, but I mean, I just always loved hanging with him and Joe Garney on the trail. And to be losing people like that is to me so deeply emotionally moving that, you know, Robbie and I actually, the publisher, Roberta Graham at Plaid Cabin, have actually talked about, you know, trying to set up some kind of fund and taking some of the proceeds from the book to try and help out some rural mushers get back into this, because I just hate to see that part of it go.
Yeah, is there an inherent ability for those guys? I mean, everything changes and sporting events change, and you know, you can't get off of your couch and, you know, to use the NASCAR analogy, and take your you know, your Gran Torino and run around Daytona with the guys who do it for a living. Do you think it's a natural progression of the Iditarod that kind of evolved to this more professional format, or do you think it's a decision that was made and that this is the way the race is going?
Oh, no, I think it's an inevitable progression. I mean, I think there's it's a normal thing among people to try and want to excel. And I think what we've seen here is people trying to get better. They become, you know, the trails become better. The race has made the trail better. Training has become better. Everything's done better. I mean, the easiest way to level some of that playing field might to be just to cut back a little bit on the way they maintain the trail and not provide such a good trail for the front runners, which would certainly slow the front down and bunch everyone up.
Yeah. Do you think there's anything else ITC can do to keep it as one race and keep it interesting for both levels of competitor?
Boy, it's hard because, I mean, some of those guys at the front now are so good and so talented and so efficient at what they do that, you know, trying to keep them in check is a pretty hard thing to do. I mean, they're going to go really fast almost no matter what you do.
Right. Right.
Yeah, Greg. We also, if you did have like basically a segmented race, which wouldn't be a staged race really, but a race where there was two classes, as you're saying, you'd have more of a logistical situation because everybody would have to be resupplied. So Craig uses the simile of a snake with a big bulge in the middle, and all the logistics is in the middle of the snake, and they don't like to be the tail to be too far behind. And now you'd have a whole other snake back there.
Yeah, and as a practical reality, I mean, I don't know, you know, we have like the U.S. Open for golf, and there are amateurs and professionals in there, but they all kind of end up mixed together anyway. So I'm not sure how it would aid or help the logistical thing we hear, which is a big part of the problem in staging this race.
Hey, Greg, I want to thank you for your call, and I'm enjoying the discussion, but I want to get some more callers and so forth.
Sure. Thanks a lot, and best of luck with the book, Craig.
Thanks, Greg.
All right.
All right.
Where is that place that dot place you're going in Anchorage with the book?
Steam Dot, which is Jonathan White's new coffee shop out in South Anchorage. It's kind of across from Lowe's out there on the old Seward Highway.
It's July.
It's kind of interesting how we locate things in America today, isn't it? It's across from the Lowe's on the Seward Highway.
Yeah, it's building
it's
supplies,
between there
man.
And the Alaska Club. Right. Name the biggest building, everyone can find it.
Yeah, and that's July what?
That's July 7th from 5 to 7.
All right, just helping you do your duty there. You're as I say in the book, Steve, you haven't thrown that in yet.
The publisher would be pounding on my head if I didn't.
She will. Let's go to Bob, who joins the program from Bethel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Thank you. Craig, Bob Sepp.
Hey, Bob Sepp, how are you doing?
Good. I just want to tell everybody out there, Craig and I go back a long way. We've both been involved with the race since the way early 80s. Craig, and he'd bring a photographer, and I can't remember, Jim?
Jim Lavrakis, who's now a fishing guide in Homer.
Yeah, and so you'd be on the Iditarod in the early 80s, and you hardly ever saw a snow machine, people going from Anchorage to Nome, and here would come Craig and Jim and pulling a big sled, and they truly covered the race like nobody had ever done it. They were actually out there on foot, and it was always the best coverage, great coverage. So I'm glad to see you write this book. I haven't read it, but from what I gather, it's kind of a human interest issue, and, you know, we see the musher run the race, but we never see all the families and friends behind these people. And when somebody would scratch or have difficulties, you'd always see the families, and these people would be crying and the emotional drain on them. And because they'd all sacrificed, a lot of people sacrificed a lot of things in their lives to get one musher down the trail. So I'm really looking forward to reading that book. Second thing I'd like you to get your comment on is the effect that humane societies have had on the race, because from being on the board, I saw firsthand how devastating the press and I wouldn't say it's so much Anchorage press, but it's the press from outside that gives so much attention to these groups. They call themselves humane groups, but all they're trying to do is really generate a lot of money by picking on certain animal rights issues, and then through that they're able to go with their own program. And the problem it had for the committee is it would be devastating for sponsorship, and yet nobody would ever cover the other side, like what the veterinary group has done, what education they've done for the mushers, how much smarter mushers are today, and how much we've learned. And, you know, if you look at just the number of dog deaths, they've drastically decreased over the years, and there's a real premium on dog care out there. But that never gets to be put out very much.
Well, and I don't know how you deal with those people, because they fundamentally do not understand that in order to do this race, you've really got to love dogs. I mean,
Yes.
Having watched these people, I can't conceive of how you could do this unless you love dogs. It's a babysitting competition for 1,000 miles.
I don't know, Bob. I think, the vehemence of the protests against the Iditarod has died out compared to what it was, say, in the mid-80s when it did get a little fevered. But it seems to me in recent years they really haven't attacked it all that much. There is one group that, kind of has a website and continues with the, but I'm not really sure it has that much of an audience anymore.
If you look to sponsorships, a lot of sponsorships, the big ones like IMS went out the door, and there's a lot of sponsorships that are afraid to touch it now because they're aware that once they do, there's a tremendous campaign against their company for sponsoring that.
Yeah, well, the HSUS is never going to love the race. I think we could be pretty sure of that.
No, I don't think they're ever going to love the race either, but I think you can get those sponsors back, and I think you can build coalitions with other, people who love dogs to change some of that. I mean, I think with the right packaging, IOMS could be brought back.
Well, that's encouraging to hear. The problem is exposing is we don't get much media covering what we're really doing behind the scenes for dog care, and that never seems to get publicized much. It's always the other, and it makes it tough for the committee. I mean, the committee's trying to put enough money up there so that they can have a decent purse. These people just don't go broke running a race, and. It was a difficult issue for us. I still think we get a lot of people that kind of shy away that could potentially be good. And and how do you fight it? I don't know. But we really need help from somebody who through the media that wants to really expose what's done for the race positively.
Well, and it becomes a doubly difficult issue because the decision to put straw out for dogs in every checkpoint has significantly increased the logistical cost of putting a race on.
Sure.
Yeah. Hey, Bob.
Good luck with it, Craig. And I'm really glad you took this subject on.
Well, thanks.
All right. Thanks.
All right, take care.
Great to hear from you, Bob. Let's go to Brian. Joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Brian.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Medrid. This is Brian O'Donohue.
Brian O'Donohue. Another Iditarod rider.
Yeah. Greg, it's a great topic, and I really enjoyed his coverage in the Dispatch this year. And the whole thing of what goes in the backpack and what motivates them is just an excellent topic.
Well, I hope you've bought the book, Brian.
Well, I tried. I was one of the early people trying to buy it, and I will pick it up now that it's got more mainstream.
Get right online, go to Fireside Books in Palmer, and they'll have it shipped off today.
There you go. Okay.
It's not, I just want to tell you, it started off going to be a compilation of what you read in Dispatch, and it went way beyond that, and... It rolled a whole lot of other things in there, and I think you in particular would enjoy it. And
and I just know through the years, how you've really followed the race and given this all a lot of thought and seen the consequences. And that's one of the things I wanted to call about is that, when I entered the race, I mean, one of my big motivations was to finish because of what I had observed as a reporter of the folks who scratch. And it just is a overwhelming sort of... shadow across their whole lives, and folks get caught into that, and it takes them years of sort of beating their head against the wall sometimes to
yeah, I think Emil may be one of those people. I hope he emerges from this. Brian, by the way, for those who don't know, did the race and wrote a book about doing the race, and I remember Brian well because he was with a bunch of mushers stuck coming down out of Rainy Pass when Lavrakis and I showed up on snow machines one year.
Yes,
I don't think
the cavalry when you guys came through in snow machines.
I don't think I've ever seen a group of people so happy to see me.
Yeah, I had snowshoes on, and as people who follow the race these days will maybe be aware. That doesn't happen too much anymore. I mean, we had a big dump of snow and no trail, and you just got to fight your way through. The other point I wanted to make is really what one of the things that people get out of it when they do succeed is a tremendous sense of accomplishment, and in part because they've solved problems. And all of the really good mushers learn to solve problems because things don't go the way you expect. And the person who scratches is often doing it at a low point when their sort of just whole psychic energy is just at its nadir, and it seems to them like they have no alternative and no choice. And as a reporter, a lot of times what I observed was that just wasn't the case, but it was a matter of them psyching themselves into it, and then the dog team picks it up like an emotional sponge, and it seems to be hopeless.
Dogs, the ability of dogs to pick up on emotion, whether positive or negative, astounds me.
Oh yeah. You know, and really good mushers, too. They kind of inspire their team. They stay happy in the face of you know, really, devastating setbacks. Everybody out there who succeeds is contending with broken sleds from time to time, from dogs that, you know, pick up freak injuries, from, weather that exposes weaknesses in your team. But getting past it, adjusting, solving the problems, is part of what you walk away with and part of what really is important to take away from the race.
Yeah, the hardest thing most people will never do. I'm still astounded in the details in the book. How many more people have made the summit of Everest than have reached Nome on a dog team?
I like that.
It's mind-boggling, that comparison.
Yeah, I really like your observation there, Brian. I think that is true. There are many things in life that present challenges to you, but there's something really relentless about this one. You would feel pretty good if you managed to get through it.
It's the duration of the event. I mean,
yeah.
A person can go out and do a marathon, and it's, you know, a lot of months of training, but basically one long day of grueling sort of effort, you know, or a couple hours for someone who's good. These long distance marathons are beyond anything you can sort of just sort of propel your way through with adrenaline and commitment, and become something that you have to pace yourself as well. You have to pace the dogs. You have to contend with the unexpected So I look forward to reading Craig's stories, because this really is the thing that I think is the event's real allure.
Well, and that I agree with you. I mean, that to me has always been the attraction.
Hey, the person who wins, to some extent, it's because things went, if not perfectly, about as well as they could have hoped. You know, maybe one or two little crises, but for the most part, you know, they won because things, you know, rolled. And today, especially with the times folks are setting, you know, it's the
well, yeah, I mean, we saw that with Mackie. It was just like, he couldn't believe what his dogs were doing.
Oh, yeah. He's the guy who's got it figured out right now.
He has an amazing ability to go to a positive place, and they all just, I mean, the psychology of sport to me has always been intriguing, and it is no more intriguing than in the Iditarod, where the coach speaks one language and all the players speak a different language. try to convey to them that emotional, psychological drive to do this is an amazing thing to watch some of these guys make a team come together and do that.
Hey, Brian, is your book still in print? My lead dog was actually a lesbian.
There's a long-time fascination by folks that are interested in the race, and I still get emails from folks in Australia who've just stumbled across, you know, my lead dog was a lesbian, and others, and Craig's going to find that experience as well.
All right. Thank you very much, Brian O'Donohue.
Nice talking to you.
All right. It's Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255. Local call in Anchorage, 550-8422. Email talk@APRN.org. Craig Medred, the guest, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
So I don't know. When I'm covering the Iditarod, I look at look to see who scratched, and it's often somebody I don't never heard of, and I think, well, they're just a loser. But Craig Medred has written about the people who did not complete this year's Iditarod, and not a one of them is really a loser.
No, none of them's a loser. I mean, there's a bunch of people who scratched, but there's no losers out there. Rising up to the challenge just to get to the starting line makes everybody a winner.
This is an email from Kevin who says, your book is about a choice. These people may be ending their dreams, but if they didn't, the book would be called Graveyard of People and Dogs. They make an intelligent choice pulling out when they do. It's a very difficult race. Sort of a little different from what the spin that Brian was putting on it. No, I think sometimes actually it's not that lethal.
Well, I think we all bury dreams. I mean, I think the important thing is that you form new ones or you dig up the old ones and go pursue them. And, I hope some of these people who did leave their dreams out there come back someday and say, I'm going to try again, Emil being among them, because it'd make me happy to see him finish. Maybe we found him a sponsor here. We brought him up so many times.
We're going to be passing the hat any second here, Emil. Let's go to Ben, joins the program from Kodiak here. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Craig Medred, Ben.
Hi, thanks. I used to be a dog handler, helped a few Iditarod mushers train dogs for a few years, and I got a chance to help out with the race for a few years. And I just kind of wanted to, the way you presented it made me want to call in because it's as if these people at the back of the pack, they really have more interesting stories a lot of the time. The people at the front of the pack, and to not to take anything away from the champions who I respect and admire tremendously, but we hear their stories a lot, and people are always fascinated by success, but that doesn't mean that the stories and the people at the back of the pack are any less interesting. And a lot of the times, the people at the back of the pack, at the front, people really have a chance. They focus on winning, and they focus on speed. And
well, I think the biggest difference is the people at the front really know what they're doing. The people at the back are often learning. And it's interesting to watch people learn because we all started somewhere. And there are some people at the front who kind of dismiss that and want to get rid of that aspect of the Iditarod and don't think people belong because they don't know enough. But to me, I mean, that's the great thing about Alaska is that you can go out there and learn.
Yeah, and they have a chance to learn together and form these incredible bonds.
Oh, they do, yes.
During this life-changing experience. And they take the time to have experiences together. And so their stories and their banquets at the end are usually way more personal and meaningful and interesting. It's a lot more interesting than just hearing somebody give a victory speech, which is thrilling in its own way. Like I said, I don't want to take anything away from the champions at all, but I think just the premise of saying who would have thought these stories would be interesting, when you're really involved in the race, you see that oftentimes the stories are much more intense and more interesting in a way.
Yeah, and friendships form, and I didn't get into this much in the book, but these kind of amazing friendships form where people can be apart for years, and they come back together on the trail, and it's like they were never apart. They're like immediately reconnect.
Sure, yeah.
These are realities that aren't shared among that many people. Ben, that's very well put, and I want to thank you for your call from Kodiak.
Well, thank you.
Maybe we should bring up the case of John Stewart. He almost made it.
Poor John Stewart. John's a really fit, talented young guy who'd spent a lot of time behind a dog team and thought it would be easy because of that, and it went everywhere but easy. And he came so close. I feel for him. I mean, the guy's a diver in the North Sea. He's engaged in one of the most dangerous professions in the world. He grew up on a dog sled, you know, not far from where Seppala was born. He's immersed in the history. He goes out, he thinks, oh, how hard can this be? It can be really, really hard.
Yeah. It blew me totally out of the water there. Thinking about this guy and how he really should have made it.
He really should have made it, and it just, you know, things went wrong. He went out too fast. Dogs got sick. They got tired. Next thing he knew, he really didn't have a dog team left. And I think he was as befuddled as anyone as to how it could all go so wrong. And that, I think, for John was the toughest part, just not being able to figure out what happened.
Yeah, you know, I kind of miss the Norwegians.
Yeah, I miss the Norwegians. I think the race misses the Norwegians, but yeah. I think it kind of underlines the difficulty here of how you do it, both for an individual musher and for the Iditarod. Because, I mean, for the Iditarod, when you talk about sponsorship, it's only on the horizon for like 3 weeks out of the year. So what do you get as a sponsor? And it really, yeah. I mean, one of its problems, it needs to figure out how to spread its shoulders so it's more talked about and more dealt with before and after.
Well, we're doing our little bit.
Well,
we?
I know we're doing a little bit, and I hope it helps them. And I've kind of talked to the Iditarod itself in the past about, you know, extending their coverage into these people because they can draw out their online presence for another couple weeks.
Well, okay, let's see if we can get one more call in here. Roy and Beryl, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, great. I was just going to ask, quick, when he did a story in the Bear Creek, he met up with a man, like in the 1920s, they tried to mush up to the North Slope to take pictures of a crossing by a dirigible. Did you do that story, or Mike Dugan?
I think Doug O'Hara might have done that story. I remember that story, though.
Great story.
About five dog teams with 20 dogs, and they ended up walking in the tundra with like five dogs left, and my dad find them in the Carvel Delta.
Yeah, I think Doug wrote that story. I remember that story, though. It was amazing. It was amazing.
God, I love this show. You get calls like this. Roy from Barrow, we're running out of time here. I want to thank you so much for your call, though. That was great. Well, look, Craig Medred, you think you'll go on the race next year?
Well, Tony at Alaska Dispatch is trying to get me to. I don't know, and I've got a couple other book ideas just because there's so many interesting people in Alaska. It's really nice to get out of an office and.
Nice to get out of office.
Well, it is. I mean, it's nice to get out of an office and really, you know, have a chance to hang with people and talk to people, and they're interesting.
All right. Craig Medred, author of Graveyard of Dreams. It's on sale now. Next week on Alaska's Talk of Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Progress. Dave Waldron on the controls. Josh Edge on the phone. I'm Steve Heimel.
Made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. In today's competitive business climate, the advantage lies in reducing cost and increasing efficiencies. A safe and healthy workplace reduces cost and improves productivity. To get started, contact the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Occupational Safety and Health Consultation and Training Program at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.